I like how this is an accidental over caffeination. So you're like doing espresso shots or something.
Yeah, pretty much.
Okay, got it.
Gonna have a wicked crash here in about 45 minutes. I can feel it coming along.
All right, well, we'll get this done.
You know what that sound means. It's time for the Michigan DNR's Wild Talk Podcast. Welcome to the Wild Talk Podcast, where representatives from the DNR's Wildlife Division chew the fat and shoot the scat about all things habitat, feathers, and fur. With insights, interviews, and your questions answered on the air, you'll get a better picture of what's happening in the world of wildlife here in the great state of Michigan.
Welcome to Wild Talk. I'm your host, Hannah Schauer, and with me, as always, is the lovely Rachel Leitner. Rachel, would you let folks know about what we have in store for them on this exciting episode?
Of course I would, Hannah. The month of May can be a lively time for some of our favorite parasitic arachnids, the tick. So we thought that this would be a good time to rerun one of our favorite interviews about ticks with Dr. Dan O'Brien, Dr. Jean Sow, and Dr. Megan Porter. Now, this interview is all about ticks and tick-borne illnesses and a great reporting tool, the Tick App.
Yes, and we're going to be zhuzhing up our around the state updates, and each episode will feature an update from one of our regional representatives. So this episode, we'll be talking with Terry McFadden, one of our wildlife field operation managers, and hearing all about the spring and summer work going on in the southeastern region of the state. And of course, we'll be answering your questions from the mailbag. But first, we're going to shine our wildlife spotlight on the Blanding's turtle. We have 10 terrific turtles here in Michigan, and today we're going to talk a little bit about the Blanding's turtle.
A characteristic feature of the Blanding's turtle is the yellow chin, throat, and lower portion of its long neck. The carapace, or the shell, of the Blanding's turtle is quite smooth and may have tan or yellow streaks. An adult carapace length averages 6 to 11 inches.
Yeah, and Blanding's turtles prefer shallow, weedy ponds, marshes, and swamps. In the spring, however, adults may travel overland to look for a mate and suitable nesting site. In Michigan, Blanding's turtles can be found throughout the Lower Peninsula and much of the Upper Peninsula as well.
Now, females may travel half a mile from water to find suitable nesting sites. Open, sunny spots with sandy soils are usually preferred, but most nesting occurs in June. Hatchlings will emerge in August or early September, and interestingly, the temperature at which the eggs incubate determines the sex of the hatchlings. So cooler temperatures will yield males, while warmer incubation temperatures will produce females.
So strange to think about that temperature impacting the gender of the hatchlings. Who knew? Many turtle nests suffer loss due to predation by raccoons, fox, and skunks, among other species. And it's hard to be a hatchling turtle because the little hatchlings are also heavily preyed upon by the species I previously mentioned, as well as other species like fish, snakes, large birds, and a whole suite of other animals like to eat those little baby turtles. So as far as turtle nests and eggs and hatchlings, there's a high mortality rate there.
But if a Blanding's turtle can make it to adulthood, it will take them 15 to 22 years to reach sexual maturity. Now, these Blanding turtles are relatively long-lived, as some individuals report to be over 60 years old and still reproducing. That is quite a feat in the animal world. One female in Michigan was known to reach at least 83 years old.
It's incredible. Very long-lived species. Mm-hmm. Now, even though adult turtles have more protection from predators, they do experience a lot of road mortality. Female turtles looking for suitable places to lay their eggs are particularly at risk due to their overland travels to find those nesting spots. Additionally, with Blanding's turtles taking so much time to reach sexual maturity and only a few young turtles reaching adulthood, impacts to the numbers of adults by road mortality can have impacts on the local populations. And this is applicable to other turtles and turtles in general, because most species experience that high nest mortality that I mentioned, and there's that significant time before adults are sexually mature.
Yeah, road mortality can take out not just Blanding's turtles, but a whole suite of other turtles. So when you see a turtle on the side of the road, should we stop and help them across?
Yeah, folks can certainly do that. It's good to be aware of your surroundings and only do so if it's safe for you. You know, our human safety is very important, so you want to make sure it's safe to do so. And then it's also important to remember to only move the turtle just to the side of the road and in the direction it was heading. If you move it back the opposite way, it's just going to turn around and try and cross the road again. So always move it in the direction it was heading. Don't take them and move them somewhere else completely. Several different species have fairly small home ranges, so if you move them a mile or two, even down the road, they're going to be lost and confused and not be able to find their way home. So just move them the shortest distance to get them off of the road in the direction they're traveling, and then let them go about their day.
I'm so glad you brought up moving the turtle in the direction it was heading, because so often you might see a turtle that's, you know, only a foot across the road. And so you might just move them to whatever side of the road is closer. But turtles have destinations in mind. And so even if they're put back a direction they didn't want to go, they're still going to try to get across the road. And so it's, I feel like that's a really important way to assist a turtle rather than, you know, put it where you think it might be safest, put it in the direction that it's trying to go. So thanks for that tidbit, Hannah. It's always helpful to know what to do when we find turtles crossing the road, which is going to happen, especially in the next couple of months. Now back to the Blanding's turtles. So in terms of diet, a Blanding's turtle's preferred prey are crayfish, but they will also eat leeches, worms, snails, frogs, small fish, and also some plants. So a bit of an omnivorous species.
The Blanding's turtle, also important to note for folks, is a species of special concern here in Michigan. So we are very interested to know if you have seen one, as well as some other species of turtles. So if you are out, say, spring turkey hunting, or maybe just exploring natural areas, parks, trails, or even your own neighborhood, and you happen to see a Blanding's turtle, eastern box turtle, spotted turtle, or wood turtle, or even an eastern Massasauga rattlesnake for that matter, please report your observations at michigan.gov/eyes-in-the-field. That would be super helpful for us learning more about their distribution and current population status.
Yep. If you enjoyed learning about the Blanding's turtle, you can learn more about it as well as Michigan's other turtle species by visiting michigan.gov/wildlife. You will want to stick around. Next, we'll be hearing from Terry McFadden, and we'll find out what is happening with habitat work in the Southeast region.
Pure Michigan hunt applications are on sale now. If you want your shot of what is considered Michigan's ultimate hunt, pick up a $5 application or two. There's no limit to the number you can buy. If you're one of the three lucky winners, you'll get a hunting prize package worth thousands, as well as licenses for elk, bear, spring and fall turkey, antlerless deer, and first pick at a managed waterfowl area for a reserved hunt. Purchase anywhere hunting licenses are sold or online at michigan.gov/PMH.
Welcome back. Here with us today in our virtual recording studio is Terry McFadden, a field operations manager in Southeast Michigan. Terry, welcome to the show and thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. Real excited to talk about things that staff are doing, all the exciting work and some of the new projects we got going on in Southeast.
Awesome. Well, let's jump into those projects. What are some key projects in Southeast Michigan that wildlife staff will be focused on throughout the spring and summer months this year?
Well, it's turkey season, so we got to talk a little bit about turkeys, I suppose. It's always exciting. It's a special interest to a lot of folks around the state, especially in Southeast Michigan. I think Michigan's ranked like 8th in the nation for the amount of turkeys that are harvested, and we got a lot of opportunity here. State game areas are fantastic, a lot of diverse habitat, a lot of food plots and things that attract turkeys. You know, people that have access to private land, they have some fantastic hunting opportunities as well. Something we did a couple years ago is we dedicated the Holly Turkey Tract, and that was exciting to get that on the ground. And that's turkey tracts are intensively managed sites specifically for, you know, for turkey habitat and turkey hunting, anything you think about with turkey, you know, trail networks, food plots, roosting habitat, big hardwoods, you know, openings for display, You know, they've got them. So that the Holly unit has a turkey tract. It's 300 acres. It's got a couple miles of hunter walking trails and a number of food plots, really cool openings, northern hardwoods, big pines for roosting. And there's a lot of information online on National Wild Turkey Federation and our now retired upland game bird specialist, Al Stewart. We're instrumental at pushing the whole topic of turkey tracks and doing some intensive work. And I think the Holly unit's really a Cadillac example of some of the work that our staff have done. You know, our wildlife technician and biologist over there did a lot of the planning and we have a wildlife assistant who's retired now, but he did a lot of the groundwork and it just looks amazing. It's got a lot to offer. And, you know, National Wild Turkey Federation put up a really nice kiosk. It's got a lot of information on it. But so that one was dedicated in 2019. We've got two others that are coming online too. They were supposed to be dedicated last year. They got postponed for obvious reasons. One is up in Tuscola County at the Deffert State Game Area, and another one in Waterloo in Jackson County. The Waterloo units is actually a Sharonville State Game Area. So those two are coming on. We have another one that will probably be up and running in the next year or two at Port Huron State Game Area in St. Clair County. So we've got only one online, that's the Holly unit, or the Holly turkey track, but we've got three others in the works that will be dedicated soon. So it's pretty exciting to see that stuff come up and get rolling.
Any other projects happening that might benefit hunters or people who are planning to hunt this fall?
Yeah, the Lapeer shooting range is brand new. So that's a really cool project. People know it as the Lapeer Pit. It's on Rood's Lake Road in Lapeer County, but it wasn't staffed, you know, by any DNR folks. You know, it had complaints from, you know, residents and neighboring people, and it got real political. There's always a lot of things that happen when you have just willy-nilly shooting that takes place. Even though we might post rules, there's, you know, you still end up with trash to deal with, and some people use illegal devices like incendiary or explosives that are totally illegal on state land. But, you know, we want to promote shooting sports as well. So we applied for grants and we put some effort into making this into a really top-notch shooting range, and it'll be staffed. But it's pretty cool. It was supposed to be coming online on May 1st. That's the target date that we're shooting for. There's some other details that we're working through right now. But, you know, there was a lot that went into it. Acoustic tests, soil and water tests, topography and engineering and things. But it's going to have backstops. It's going to be very safe. It'll be open 3 days a week, Thursday, Friday, Saturdays through the summer, 11 a.m. to 7 p.m. And from October 1st to December 15th, that'll be Thursday, Friday, Saturday as well. It's going to have 11 shooting lanes, 3 at 10 yards, 5 at 25 yards, and 3 at 100 yards. ADA accessible parking pathway and accessible rustic restroom. You know, it's going to be super safe. Ricochet baffles, acoustic buffering, and a perimeter fence. So there won't be, you know, the issue of trespassing or anything else. People know where they're at. You know, we're excited to bring that thing on, and hopefully people will check it out. It's funded through Pittman Robertson, through the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and a Natural Resources Trust Fund grant. So it should be pretty good for people and safe.
Those are awesome projects. They've got a lot of great hunter engagement and opportunity involved in those. How about any projects specific to wildlife or any particular habitat type?
Yep. So let's see, back in 2013, we started working on black tern monitoring on the St. Clair Flat. National Audubon had approached us and were asking about black terns. We knew we had them, but we really didn't know. We didn't put a lot of effort into monitoring them because they're widespread across St. Clair Flats. If anybody has any questions about the flats, it's the largest freshwater delta in the nation, in North America at least, possibly the world. And you know, black terns are really cool birds, but they're declining pretty fast. So they're a species of concern. But Audubon, National Audubon approached us, and at first it was just a handful of people discussing black terns back when water levels were really low. And through the years, we began monitoring. We had volunteer folks coming on to help monitor these birds. And one of them was, we had a guy, Randy Kling. He was a special mention just because he's an avid waterfowl hunter at Harson's Island. He knows the flats really well, but he's an exceptional birder too. He took on a lot of the monitoring himself. And, if it wasn't for him, I don't think the project would really got off the ground. But through the years, we learned a lot about black terns. And with the high water that we've had, we went from extreme low water conditions in 2013 to extreme high conditions and like record highs, you know, recently. So what we've seen is a lot of the emergent marsh and structure that they like to nest on disappear over the years. And so they've been moving inland further and further with a lack of emergent habitat that's out on the flats these days. We're seeing more and more use of these inland sites. So we're working together with Audubon, and the work that we're going to do will not only benefit black terns, but it'll benefit a host of other species, especially waterfowl, and be really good for waterfowl hunting too. It'll make some of the these closed-in openings, it'll expand them, it'll increase diversity and edge structure out there with the different habitat types. So we're excited to get that project kickstarted, and Detroit Audubon has been included with it. You know, they've had they've had staff come out and do a lot of the work. So, you know, it's not just National Audubon anymore. It went from National Audubon to our local chapter, Detroit Audubon, and now there's a ton of attention. Like, we'll have meetings talking about black terns, and there'll be, you know, 30-40 different, you know, people on these teams meetings these days talking, you know, for representing, you know, many, many different agencies and organizations that are all interested in black terns. And it expanded from the St. Clair Flats all across the state. So, and into the, you know, Great Lakes region. I mean, there's people from Ontario that are looking at monitoring and looking at some of the techniques with nesting platforms and other things to restore some of the structure that these things like to nest on. So, and just to elaborate on that a little bit, I mean, black terns are, they nest on these little tiny floating mats of debris that they find and put together. Their eggs are only a couple inches off the water, you know, most times. But, you know, since they float, they move around and, you know, they can get flipped over, destroyed through storm events. They like protected little bays, you know. So anytime you can have like a protected area with some floating debris, it doesn't matter if it's really, you know, bulrush or a piece of styrofoam that broke off of a, you know, a structure or something. If it's floating, they'll try to nest on it. And, but with, you know, the higher water and you know, more lake effect, getting into the bays, it's harder for them to find places to nest. And we've seen their numbers decline even here on the flats.
It's so awesome to hear about all of the partners and people who are excited and interested in helping out black terns and looking at their habitat, learning a little bit more about them. So it's a really cool project. I'm glad you could share it with us. Anytime we can learn a little bit more about species is pretty neat.
Yeah. There's a, you know, a really big mallard study that's going on across the Great Lakes region. So it's included in with Michigan, Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, and Wisconsin. Michigan State University is taking the lead on it. And, you know, we've got a PhD student that's working on putting bands on and these monitors. But it's cool. It's GPS monitor along with Global System for Mobile Communications. So it's a GSM transmitter. It's solar powered. It uses cell phone technology. And these little devices are being attached to 350 mallards across, you know, these states around the Great Lakes, where people can, you know, download their positions in like real time. These researchers can and learn about, you know, where they're nesting these days. One of the things we got concerns about is that, you know, we're engaged in the spring breeding waterfowl survey, and we're looking for nesting waterfowl across the state, running transects. But it's hard to monitor and survey in urban areas because we can't fly low enough over buildings and houses. But we know that mallards nest in, you know, some urban areas. And so, you know, we're targeting places in urban environments as well as like rural habitats and taking genetics, and a lot of things are going to be looked at, you know, over the course of this study to learn more about, you know, some of these urban habits and comparisons between, you know, the ducks that we have out here. So it's interesting. It's be a long-term project and work that's going in by, you know, multiple agencies across all these states. It's a pretty big scope, and, you know, hopefully we'll learn a lot from it.
This sounds like a really cool project, and I'm really excited to see kind of the results in the future. I'm glad that you could share it with us. So, Terry, we really appreciate you coming on the show today and letting us know about all the great work happening in southeastern Michigan for wildlife, as well as our wildlife enthusiasts. And so we really appreciate you taking some time out of your day to talk with us today.
It's exciting to be on to promote what we're doing.
All right. So for our listeners, next month, we'll be hearing an update from the Upper Peninsula. So you won't want to miss that. And next up is our chat about ticks. Don't go anywhere.
There are many camping and lodging opportunities available in Michigan's state parks. When you choose State Park Campgrounds, you get more than just a campsite. State parks offer a diverse range of recreational opportunities, including hands-on instructional classes, nature programs, places to fish, boat launches, family-friendly events, and much more. Reservations can be made 6 months in advance, so why wait? Visit MIDNRreservations.com or call 1-800-44-PARKS to make a reservation.
With all the tick activity we've already been hearing about this year, we thought it would be a good time to reshare our interview from August 2019, which is all about ticks.
Yes, this interview had a lot of great information on tick-borne illnesses and how you can report ticks and get them identified and tested. So, without further delay, we'll let you dive into the interview. Enjoy!
All right. Well, we are jam-packed here today in the studio. There's six of us in here. So today here in studio, we have Dr. Dan O'Brien of the DNR Wildlife Disease Lab and Dr. Jean Sow of, she is an associate professor of the Fisheries and Wildlife Department over at Michigan State University. And we have Dr. Megan Porter, a graduate student also at Michigan State University. Welcome to all three of you. Thank you for being here today.
Thanks for having
us.
So today we're talking about ticks. And we are finding more and more lately with our phone calls and emails that we get into our department, people are looking for tick-related information and have concerns about ticks. And growing up, I don't really remember ticks being much of an issue in Michigan. It seems like, you know, things are changing. Has something changed, or was I just unaware of the tick situation when I was younger?
So Holly, I think the situation is changing, and this is largely due to the fact that the black-legged tick, also known as the deer tick, which is the vector for the Lyme disease pathogen, has been increasing in its abundance and in its spatial distribution within Michigan. And that's not unlike other places in the U.S. But in Michigan, actually, there have been many tick species here already, but the most prevalent one is the American dog tick. And that's been around, and it's been around in the Upper Peninsula and in the Lower Peninsula. But in the late or mid-80s, 1980s, the black-legged tick was first discovered in Menominee County in the UP. And then since that time, it's been spreading somewhat in the UP. But then, sometime in the early 2000s, it was detected, the same tick, in southwestern Michigan. And then over that time, it's just been spreading. It may have been here in low numbers before in the Lower Peninsula in the late 90s or in early 2000s. But certainly something then changed and its abundance just grew. And we first saw it really kind of, as far as ticks go, racing up the lakeshore, Lake Michigan, in those coastal dune forests. And students in my lab had studied beginning in 2004, and actually some Eric Foster, who was at the Michigan Department of Health and Human Services, actually he started studying this with Ned Walker and other folks at the Michigan DNR, including Steve Schmidt at the time, who was the state veterinarian at the time. They had looked at black-legged ticks on hunter-harvested deer in the early 2000s, and they saw that there were some more ticks in southwestern Michigan. And then when my student Sarah Hamer came, she was working with Dr. Graham Hickling, who used to be here with me also, and we saw the tick progressing up the Lake Michigan lakeshore up to from southwest Michigan up to Sleeping Bear Dunes in the matter of I would say 6-7 years.
Wow.
And the numbers just, you know, have increased. And now certainly the ticks have spread inland a bit, and Lansing is a little bit of a hotbed in certain areas for the black-legged tick, and they've actually reached over to the Lake Huron shoreline. But the distribution's still patchy, so some areas in the state, we still have a very hard time finding the black-legged tick, but in other areas, I think a lot of people, including yourself, have been noticing more ticks. And then on top of that, unfortunately, not as much has been studied really carefully looking at the changes in the dog tick, American dog tick numbers. But from what I understand, talking to people like Dan O'Brien and others who spend lots of time outdoors, it seems that the dog tick has been increasing in abundance as well. So even though it's widespread, the numbers seem to be increasing more.
That's the one I see most often.
And you hadn't
when
seen
I
it
find
much
a
when
tick
you
on
up.
Me, That's it's right. usually a dog tick. So yeah. Well, you've talked a little bit about black-legged ticks and the dog tick. Can you explain maybe the differences between those and any other tick species that might be found here in Michigan?
Yeah, well, here in Michigan, as you were just saying, the American dog tick is, well, the most commonly found tick by people and their companion animals. And we know that from data that of tick submissions to the state health department, as well as my graduate student has been looking at pictures received by the public through the tick app. And then also in her work looking at ticks that are presented on dogs from veterinarians. And so the American dog tick is the most prevalent. Then it's the black-legged tick. And then from time to time, we also get on dogs and people this tick called the woodchuck tick, which is in the same family as the black-legged tick. And then there are a few others that are much less commonly run into by people and companion animals. The differences are, well, visually they look different, but also they are different because they, from a human health standpoint and animal health standpoint, they transmit different pathogens. And so the American dog tick is most well known for transmitting the Rocky Mountain spotted fever and other bacteria in the spotted fever group, and which can they can cause people to feel like they have the flu and such, and Rocky Mountain spotted fever can be fatal. However, those pathogens are at much lower prevalence amongst the tick population. So we rarely hear about people in Michigan contracting Rocky Mountain spotted fever, although it happens every few years. And then we hear, you know, some press releases to remind people that beware of this. You still have to be aware of this tick causing problems, even though many of us have picked them off, you know, of us in the field. The American dog tick in our areas up here in the Midwest is often known as the wood tick. So that's very important to get across. These are the two names for the same species. I should say as a visual, I heard this from someone. I thought it was great that the usually there are these larger brown ticks, but the female adult tick, and they come in male and female forms. She has this little creamy coloring that sometimes people call a necklace on her top side. And then the males, however, have more of this, they have a coloration pattern that extends their whole body. Some people call it looking like more like golden, like pinstripes. So a little way to differentiate the male and female dog tick.
Yes. Necklace and pinstripes.
That's right.
Or suspenders.
Nice. Yeah, right. So then the black-legged tick, or also AKA its other name is the deer tick, is the one that transmits the Lyme disease pathogen, Borrelia burgdorferi. And there are multiple stages that people can encounter, the adult stage. The female tick, she has this red covering. Her body looks mostly red, and she has a little black shield. And then the male is just pretty much all dark brown, black. And they are the size, they say the male is like the size of a sesame seed and the female's a little larger. And then the nymphal stage, or we call the teenage stage, is pretty much, it's the size of a poppy seed. And so people
that's
may-
tiny.
Yes, a little poppy seed with legs, eight legs. And more dark coloring. And then the larval stage, people hardly ever see. People might call them seed ticks if they come across them and a whole bunch come on them. But those are little, they have six legs and they're even smaller. So
you've talked a little bit about some of the human health risks that are associated with ticks. Let's dive a little deeper into the Lyme disease concern with black-legged ticks. And there is a connection, right, with deer and mice and black-legged ticks. What is that connection and what is that relationship there?
So the black-legged tick has four life stages. It's got the egg stage, then it's got the larval stage, which has six legs, the nymphs, which have eight legs, and then the adults, which come morphologically, you can actually see males and females, right? So ticks are obligate parasites. They have to get a blood meal at every stage. So the larva is going to be looking for a host. And these ticks also, they don't run after anyone and they don't fly and they don't drop from trees.
They don't drop out of trees on right. people's heads either.
That's right. And so they, the mom lays the eggs in one clutch, something like 500 to 2,000 eggs at one time. Then the larvae emerge, they hatch out of their eggs and they are hungry and they're looking for a host. So they will wave their front pair of legs in this term we call questing for a host. And because ticks don't have antennae, but they have little organs at the tip of their front pair of legs, right under their claws, and they wave them in the air and they sense things like heat, passage of light, maybe some carbon dioxide that hosts might emanate. And then so when a host comes by, they also feel vibrations, you know, such, and they may attach. So then they'll attach to a host, and there can be many different species of hosts that larvae feed on. People have counted maybe 100, 150. It depends. They're generalist ticks, parasites. So they will feed on small mammals, mice, voles, shrews. They'll feed on birds and eat that forage on the ground. So robins, catbirds.
Oven birds,
yes. And in certain places, if they exist, they will feed on lizards as well. So we saw a great picture from one of our summer workers from Port Crescent State Park that was of a five-line skink. So they will feed on five-line skinks. They love skinks. And they will then definitely feed on medium-sized and large-sized mammals. So raccoons, possums, skunks, squirrels, and then white-tailed deer, as well as bear, etc. So the larvae can feed on all of these, but they tend to feed mostly on probably the small mammals, in part because the small mammals are so numerous and in their habitat running around in our woods here.
Just more likely, basically, that they'll run into a rodent than
yes.
a lot of other things.
Right. And then what happens is they take their blood meal. They're on the host for about 3-4 days, takes them that long to suck enough blood to be fully engorged. And larvae are born without the infection. So at that point, if the host is infected, they will suck in the pathogens, right? These spirochetes that cause Lyme disease. Then what will happen is when these larvae, when they finish feeding, they'll detach from the host, drop into the leaf litter, and they will undergo development and molt into the nymphal stage. So they'll grow another pair of legs, they'll be a little bigger. And if they were infected in their larval blood meal, they will then be infected as unfed nymphs, hungry to get on another host. And then when a host passed by, and again, all the same types of hosts, these nymphs would be feeding on just like they had as larvae. Then if it's a host species that actually can get infected with the Lyme disease pathogen, because not all hosts can, then the nymph will transmit that pathogen to the host. And then that host will become infected and be able to pass it back to any other larvae or nymphs that feed on it. If the nymph then, after it finishes feeding, it's infected, it drops into the leaf litter to molt into the adult. When it comes out as a male or a female, it will be infected. But the female and the male, what happens next, right? So they need a blood meal, but they also need to find each other and mate. That's the job of the adult tick. And so what they do, again, unlike mosquitoes, they don't fly around and they don't do massive migrations to find a host and find each other. What happens is they just wait and they queue to a large host. And in our ecosystems, the most abundant large host is the white-tailed deer. And so when they do that, They get on a host, then they're actually able to get their blood meal, and they're probably going to be likely to find their mate. So I often say in my classes, it's just like when people want to find each other to, you know, a partner or spouse, instead of going out just randomly, they go to a bar. Something like that. Coffee shop bar, whatever is your
place. Right, so the deer is like a tick bar.
Exactly. And for audiences who might remember, I think of it as like a tick love boat.
There you go.
Romantic.
Right. And it's cruising around in the woods. Right. And then, but the thing is, in terms of infection, the deer aren't competent hosts. They cannot be hosts for the pathogen, I should say. They're great hosts for the adult ticks, and the female takes the large blood meal, and once she's mated, then she's able to drop off and then lay her eggs. But in terms of, and then she dies, unfortunately. But then the deer does not become infected, so it can't ever transmit this pathogen to any other subsequently feeding ticks. But also, what happens then, it's then the whole life cycle of the pathogen comes to a screeching halt, because the female does not pass her pathogen on, you know, the Lyme disease spirochetes, onto the baby ticks. So that's why when the baby ticks are born, they're uninfected. So ticks don't transmit the pathogen onto future generations of ticks, and the hosts don't pass on the infection to their progeny. And so it has to be this tag team dynamic.
Right, which is kind of interesting to me, because they even have the name, the deer ticks. So, I mean, a lot of people think that deer play a big role in transmission of Lyme disease. But essentially what you're saying is that other than just being a sort of meeting place for the ticks and a place for them to get a blood meal, they actually cut off the infection rather than act as a source of Lyme disease for more ticks.
That's right. And so actually you see in some areas, they've seen some research in Sweden and others, the more deer you have, the lower the proportion of ticks that are infected.
Which is really interesting, because I think most of our listeners will think the opposite. You know, again, because the tick is called a deer tick, people think where you have really abundant populations of white-tailed deer, you're going to have a lot of Lyme disease, but that isn't necessarily the case.
But what happens is when you have more deer, you have more ticks.
Sure.
So proportionately, they're less infected. But number-wise, you may have more infected ticks. So then your listeners might be, they might say, maybe I was right.
There you go.
There would be more infected ticks. So, but, you know, the relationship is a little more complex than that. So you can't always predict how much Lyme disease in the tick population there will be just based on the deer population. But there are other hosts out there that vary in how well they can host the tick and the pathogen. So the host community of wildlife really plays a strong role, a large role in contributing to the what proportion of ticks are infected in a given area.
So Jean, you spoke earlier about the emergence of ticks along the west coast of Michigan from where they were, say, 20 to 30 years ago. So, I mean, what's the transport mechanism? Is it movements of these ticks on deer? So, I mean, are the deer transport hosts, or do they move on birds, or both?
Yeah, both. And so the ticks, again, they can't fly. They crawl a limited distance. And so all of their dispersal is based on the hosts they feed. So on the backs of furry hosts, you know, scaly hosts, or on the feathers of, you know, winged animals. The actual spread up the coast in the manner that it did, which was very gradual and it seemed very much continuous, that suggests to me that most of the spread was probably just by one community of hosts each year, just kind of spreading their ticks, moving them up northwards in their normal dispersal patterns.
Sure.
So, you know, every animal population, once it has their babies, babies usually have to, as juveniles, disperse somewhat. Because there aren't enough resources, either food or homes, you know, for that population. So to reduce competition, they usually move. And so I think just some of that movement, and that could still be some movement, you know, for any of these hosts that host the ticks. So, but certainly perhaps with the deer, then they can move a little further depending on what deer movement is like in that area, but certainly sure. little rodents and such. Sometimes people think about, wow, you know, that distance, probably birds, maybe through migration, you know, they would be spreading. And that's definitely possible. But then we have to think about when birds would pick up ticks and when they would actually be dispersing. You know, is it, would they actually be spreading them in their breeding period when the fledglings are moving? Or is it in the fall when they are migrating and spring when they're migrating? In this case, the spring for moving northwards. But then we need to talk to the ornithologists more to see how much of that migration bringing ticks somewhere, like, for instance, the southern U.S., you know, or southwest Michigan, what would be more likely for them to be spreading ticks gradually off the coast. In some ways, I think if birds were more involved, they actually would, it may look more like a, I don't know, not shotgun, certainly, because birds, they will migrate in certain areas according to like riverine ways or, you know, other, they'll have preferred places to go. But if they were actually spreading ticks a lot more, we may see little, I would think, like bullseyes or little bombs maybe in different areas. And it may be more patchy in how they disperse the ticks as opposed to this gradual continuous movement off the lakeshore. But having said that, I bet there could be certainly little areas that are receiving ticks from birds. That might be a reason why we see some more of the spread of the black-legged tick. Certainly in some of these other far outlying areas like the coast of Lake Huron, but yet not so much in like that I-75 corridor from Midland up to the bridge. We don't seem to be seeing as many ticks there, although deer populations, you know, small mammal populations would be just as abundant there. So
it isn't just the abundance of the host for the tick either.
Yeah. And the habitat, you know, so one of the reasons why we think the coast has been good is probably why for the ticks as a first initial place was that perhaps they came down and around the lakeshore from Wisconsin through, took them a while to get through Chicago, you know, and then Indiana. But once they got here, they had these coastal forests and researchers have found that perhaps sandy soils might be a very good type of I guess, substrate, you know, the earth might be, it might be very good habitat there.
So we've talked a little bit about Lyme disease and Rocky Mountain spotted fever. What are some other dangers that might ticks pose to people?
So the deer tick or the black-legged tick can also transmit a disease called anaplasmosis, which has signs that are similar to Lyme disease in humans. And both Lyme disease and anaplasmosis can be transmitted to your family dog as well as to the rest of the members of your family. And in some cases, Lyme disease can also be transmitted to your horses. The black-legged tick or deer tick can pose that danger, that additional danger to the other members of your family. We have another very rare tick that we see sometimes in Michigan called the Lone Star tick. And a lot of times this tick is familiar to people because the adult female has this really bright iridescent white spot on her back, and she's absolutely gorgeous. But unfortunately, Lone Star ticks have been linked to what has been called a meat allergy. So there's a compound in the tick saliva when these ticks bite called alpha-gal that can cause a hypersensitivity reaction or an allergy in some people who are predisposed to it that causes them to have an allergic reaction to red meat. And that includes bacon for all of those who enjoy eating
not bacon.
Not bacon.
Anything but that.
That's usually the response I get, not the bacon. So unfortunately, these people get bitten by a tick and then hours later after they've eaten a meal that consists of some sort of red meat, they'll have this hypersensitivity reaction and they don't know why. They just wake up in the middle of the night having a severe allergic reaction and they have to go to the hospital for this. So that's something to keep in mind. We haven't seen a lot of instances of the Lone Star tick in Michigan, and we certainly don't think that it's firmly established in any great numbers in Michigan yet. But we do see handfuls of ticks that are submitted through the Tick Submission Program with the State Health Department, as well as through the Tick App, where we get pictures of ticks sent in to us.
So what are some types of ways that people could prevent potential tick bites?
So there are a couple of different strategies that you can use to prevent tick bites. So the very first strategy is to just prevent ticks from getting on you in the first place. So that includes when you go out into an area that could contain tick habitat, and that changes depending on the type of tick that you're talking about. We recommend that you wear an EPA-approved tick repellent. So this includes DEET, picaridin, lemon oil of eucalyptus, those type of products. We usually recommend that the active ingredient in that product is at least 20%. That includes most of the mosquito repellents that you find in your local store. We also recommend that you go out in long sleeves and long pants. Now, with the type of weather that we see in Michigan in July and August, that could be really difficult. But we recommend that you tuck your pants into your socks and wear tall boots if you can. In addition, there's a product called permethrin that is not to be used on your skin like DEET or picaridin, but can be used to treat your clothing. And this will actually kill and repel ticks that get onto your clothing as you're walking through tick habitat. Those strategies will help you to repel any ticks that get on you while you're out in tick habitat. We also recommend that while you're in tick habitat, stay on groomed trails. Once you've gone out into the forest, you've come home, and you've done everything that you could to prevent getting ticks on yourself, we recommend that you take a shower within 2 hours of coming home. Not that you're necessarily going to wash the ticks off, but this will give you an opportunity to do a really thorough tick check on any parts of your body that are protected, they're nice and humid, and you're not going to just brush them off. So we're thinking behind your knees, in the groin area, along the waistband, in your armpits, around the bra strap area for women, and then behind your ears and up into your hair.
So Megan, let's say one of our listeners finds a tick, then I mean, is there a correct way that you can remove those ticks? So, because there's a lot of stuff out there on the internet, some of which looks pretty sketchy.
I know that there's a lot of advice out there that you should cover it with Vaseline, or you should burn it off, or you should use alcohol on it to suffocate the tick. Don't do any of that. Because there is a threshold of time during which transmission of certain pathogens can happen, you really want to get the ticks off as fast as you possibly can and let them blood feed for as little time as possible. So we recommend that you take tweezers. The pointier the tweezers, the better. So we do recommend that you go to the hardware store and get some fine tip tweezers. They're pretty easy to find. And you want to grasp the tick as close to the skin as possible. You don't want to squeeze the tick in the middle of the body, because then you're squeezing tick guts into your cut. So you want to grasp it as close to the skin as possible. If you get a little of your skin along with the tick, you're just doing a really thorough job. So you want to grasp that tick and pull straight up and out. It might take a little bit of force to get the tick out, because they do cement themselves into your body, but you just pull that sucker out. You don't have to twist. You don't have to do anything fancy. Just pull it out. And then we recommend that you save your tick. So don't flush it down the toilet. Don't squish it and put it in the garbage. We recommend that you put it in a Ziploc bag with a moist paper towel or cotton ball, and you can put that in your refrigerator. That way, if you do become sick within, say, a month's time, you can take that tick to your doctor, and that will give them a little bit more of an idea of what illnesses they may be dealing with, since not all ticks transmit the same pathogens. We also recommend that you take a photo of it and send it either to the Tick App or to the Michigan State Health Department's photo submission. And then you can also submit your actual tick, if it's still alive, to the Michigan Department of Health and Human Services, where they have a tick identification and testing program.
What about ticks getting on your pets? Are there any prevention protocols or anything you can do to help keep your pet safe from ticks?
Oh, absolutely.
And that's really important, because also pets can present a risk to the family for ticks.
Yeah, so I always recommend that you contact your veterinarian and get a good tick prevention product from them. There are a lot of different products on the market that will also work against fleas as well, and nobody wants those in their house.
So we've been hearing a lot about this new tick app. Dr. Porter, would you be able to tell us a little bit more about what it is and what do you hope to learn from it?
Absolutely. So the Tick app is a mobile health application or app that was designed by researchers at Michigan State University, at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and Columbia University to identify the behaviors that bring people in contact with ticks. Because we talked earlier that the main way that we have to prevent tick-borne diseases is by just not contacting ticks in the first place. Unfortunately, we don't have a lot of research, especially in the Midwest, to tell us where people are contacting their ticks. So the point of the Tick app was to ask people, where are they contacting ticks? And what are they doing in their everyday lives when they're contacting these ticks, to help us identify and narrow down our prevention messages so that we can really target those behaviors and help people to do the best job to avoid ticks in the first place, and then to prevent ever developing a tick-borne disease.
So how can people participate or submit their tick data to the app?
The Tick app is available through the Apple App Store, as well as through Android app stores as well. And then there's also a website where they can go and find places where they can download the app as well.
Okay, great. And we'll be sure to include links in our show notes for folks so they can find it pretty easily. Well, thank you so much for your time. We really appreciate it. So thank you, Dr. O'Brien, Dr. Tsao, and Dr. Porter. Next, stay tuned because we're going to unzip our mailbag and answer your wildlife questions.
Now is the time to apply. Applications for your chance to hunt a Michigan black bear this fall are on sale from May 1st through June 1st. Applications are only $5. Visit michigan.gov/bear for more information.
Welcome back to Wild Talk. Now let's dig into the mailbag and answer some of your questions.
One, two, three.
The first one I have here, John wrote in asking when bobcat kill tags for the 2021 season would be available. And the 2021 fur harvester license and kill tags for bobcat, fisher, marten, and otter are all available beginning May 1st. So you can get them right now. You can purchase your base license and fur harvester license online or anywhere licenses are sold. If you request your kill tags when you purchase your fur harvester license online, please keep in mind that the kill tags will be mailed to you within 7 to 10 business days. 2021 season bobcat kill tags are available for licensed fur harvesters to obtain free of charge through November 30th, 2021. You can get marten, fisher, and otter kill tags also free of charge if you're a licensed fur harvester, and you can get those through the end of their respective seasons. Rachel, what do you have for us today?
Well, I have two questions to go over today. The first is from Marisol, who wrote in to tell us that there is a beaver building a dam on a small river that drains into a pond on her property. The river, it sounds like the river is also on her property. Now, the dam is causing the pond to hold more water than usual, and she's concerned it may begin to flood the nearby agriculture fields. And so she is writing to ask if there's anything that can be done to remove the dam and prevent any future flooding. So thanks for writing in with your question. This is a pretty common question we hear this time of year. So beavers are a game species, and they can be harvested during the open trapping season with a valid fur harvester license, and as long as you're following all applicable trapping regulations. However, the beaver trapping season is closed now, and will reopen in late October or November, depending on where you live in the state. When that time rolls around, you can find the current season dates, regulations for harvesting a beaver in the Fur Harvester Digest, which is available at michigan.gov/trapping. Now, depending on your situation, a permit can be issued by the local wildlife biologist to remove the dam. However, if the dam is big enough where you're going to need tools in order to remove it, you may need to contact the Department of Environmental Great Lakes and Energy for a dam removal permit. And they have local district offices, so you should be able to find an office near you to get that permit. Now, if you're
removing the dam or the beaver, you may also want to try installing some kind of device like a Clemson beaver pond leveler or some devices that are called beaver bafflers in or near the dam openings. And basically, these devices are going to allow the water to move through them without actually allowing a dam to be constructed there. There are damage preventions and control tips for beavers at michigan.gov/wildlife, as well as other steps you can take to remove this beaver from your private property.
Beaver baffler. Try saying that times five times fast.
It's a great twister. Name for a device. If these methods are unsuccessful, you may want to contact a permitted nuisance wildlife control business who may be able to assist with beaver removal from your private property per their regulations on their permit. If you have any additional questions or need further assistance with beaver management options in your area, please contact the local DNR wildlife biologist. You can find the contact information for your local biologist on the DNR's website, but we can also link to their contact information in the show notes. The second question I received was from Chuck to ask where he can check his bear preference points. The bear license application period has now opened, and he needs to know the amount of preference points he has so that it can help him decide which bear hunt to apply for. Thanks for this question, Chuck. You can check your bear preference points online at michigan.gov/bear. And on that website, you also can check the drawing statistics for the 2020 license drawing. And those stats can give you an idea of how many preference points were required to be drawn for a license in each hunting unit and each hunting period last year, which can give you a general idea of how to apply this year. And if you're a bear hunter, you may be interested in learning that in April, the Natural Resource Commission approved new license quotas for most bear management units. Additionally, there was two new archery-only seasons that were opened in the Northern Lower Peninsula bear management units. So initially, there was only a Red Oak archery-only season, but now it's been expanded to include Baldwin and Gladwin units as well. And it is no longer legal to use bait barrels on public lands. So if you're going bear hunting this year, these are some regulations you're going to want to take into consideration when you're making your plans. These new regulations can be found in the 2021 Bear Digest, which is available online at michigan.gov/bear and should be in stores soon. As we mentioned, the application period for bear licenses and elk licenses is open now from May 1 to June 1. Applications are $5 and they can be purchased online at michigan.gov/DNR licenses or over the counter at local license retailers. All right. And as we zip this segment to a close, remember, if you have questions about wildlife or hunting, you can call 517-284-WILD or email dnr-wildlife@michigan.gov. Your questions could be featured on the mailbag.
Now is the time to apply. Applications for your chance to hunt a Michigan elk this fall are on sale from May 1st through June 1st. Applications are just $5. Visit michigan.gov/elk for more information.
The white-tailed deer is a species probably everyone is familiar with or has some sort of experience with. They are common throughout Michigan in a variety of habitat types, including urban and suburban neighborhoods.
In the urban and suburban areas, white-tailed deer will take advantage of gardens and landscaping for food. It's like a whole buffet for deer. If you remove potential food sources and protect gardens with fencing, deer may move to other areas for food.
Oh, goodness. Yeah, I have every summer the deer come through my front garden, which is like right next to the house. But they're very brave and they come up there, eat my hostas. And if they're especially hungry, they also like to chew on my rose bushes, which always baffles me because they're thorny, but they still eat them anyway. I can understand the frustration with deer eating garden plants because it happens to me all the time. Now, hunting is one option communities may use to help manage deer populations in their area. If you are a community leader and your area experiences deer issues, our biologists can assist you in developing a management plan and reviewing options for reducing damage and conflicts with deer.
And if hunting isn't currently an option in your area, you can try some non-lethal deterrent methods to discourage deer. Some examples of deterrent methods include fencing to keep deer out of a specific area. Now, this works really well for garden beds, especially if you have raised garden beds. You can install some really good fencing over the top to keep deer out of those. You also could try using noise and visual scare tactics, or you could also try applying taste deterrents to your ornamental plants.
And one other thing that will help reduce potential conflicts with deer and that we need your help with is to keep deer from browsing on the birdseed in your feeders and on the ground beneath. So not only does eliminating food sources help reduce those potential conflicts with deer, it can also help reduce the risk of spreading diseases.
Yes, food sources like bird feeders can make deer congregate in an area, which raises the risk of deer passing diseases to other deer that are gathered there. Baiting and recreational feeding of deer remains illegal throughout the Lower Peninsula and the core CWD area in the Upper Peninsula. Now, the ban is in place to lower the risk of spreading chronic wasting disease, which is CWD, and bovine tuberculosis. Both diseases are spread through saliva and other bodily fluids that can be present at shared feeding sites.
You can help keep deer away from your feeders by using feeders that are difficult for deer to access, like tube or hopper style feeders, or even suet cages. You can also use birdseed that is less attractive to deer, like thistle, suet, and hummingbird nectar.
Only put out the amount of seed that birds will eat in a day. Deer tend to visit feeders in the evening, and if they find empty feeders, they'll likely move on. You'll also want to hang your feeders high, at least 6 feet off the ground or higher, to keep deer from accessing the seed. You also can try hanging your feeders close to the house, as deer may be less likely to approach a dwelling.
Do what you can to keep the ground under your feeders clean to prevent deer browsing, and use mess-free seed or rake the area regularly.
Mm-hmm. This will help you prevent any kind of wildlife from getting into your yard or accessing under your feeders. Little critters like possums and skunks also really enjoy eating the seed that has fallen to the ground. You also can try fencing, something like a 4 foot or taller woven wire fencing around all of your feeders to prevent deer from reaching over or through to feed on the seed. If you have a smaller yard, you could fence your yard in with the woven wire fencing that is at least 10 feet tall to prevent deer from entering.
And as long as we're talking about deer, don't forget May and June are when fawns start to show up. Enjoy the chance to see them if you get the opportunity, but please remember to leave baby wildlife in the wild, and just leave the fawns be. They're perfectly fine. Even if they're on their own, mom will be back to take care of them.
Your opportunity to win a Wild Talk podcast mug. As a thank you to our listeners, we'll be giving away a mug or two every episode.
Our April mug winners are Robert Ahrens and Aaron Mott. Check your email and we'll be getting in touch with you soon. They answered that the woodcock is the bird with the nickname of Timberdoodle,
which can be heard in their mating displays right now. And I would highly recommend that anybody go check them out in grassy areas where they might have woodcock. It's a tremendous sight to see.
Yep, and they're an evening display, so you'll probably need a headlamp, something like that. Bug spray if the mosquitoes are out.
Which they are, so that's a good recommendation. So to be entered into the drawing this month, test your wildlife knowledge and answer our quiz question. What is the only turtle species in Michigan that has a tubular snout? An additional hint, it's the only species that has a flat, scuteless carapace.
All right, so you know what to do. Email your name and answer to us at dnr-wildlife@michigan.gov to be entered for a chance to win a mug. Be sure to include the subject line as Mug Me and submit your answer by May 15th. We'll announce the winners and the answer on next month's podcast, so be sure to listen in and see if you've won. And for the next quiz question.
Yes, good luck to all of you. And now back to the podcast.
All right, I think that does it for this episode of Wild Talk. We'll see you back here in June.
This has been the Wild Talk Podcast, your monthly podcast airing the first of each month and offering insights into the world of wildlife across the state of Michigan. You can reach the Wildlife Division at 517-284-9453 or dnr-wildlife@michigan.gov.